This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
This is Keeping the Faith on WILL AM 580. Steve Shoemaker, the regular host, is away today, and this is Danny Otto filling in as guest host. Roman Catholicism is by far the largest of the Christian denominations in North America, claiming about 25% of the population. This program will look at a variety of issues as Catholics engage the broader American society in the political arena. We'll look at such things as the simultaneous resistance to the health reform package known as Obamacare by the U.S. Conference of Bishops, and support for the same reforms by a coalition of nuns, sometimes referred to as nuns on the bus. This raises questions on issues of leadership in the church. Who speaks for the Roman Catholic Church? Who has a say in formulating church positions on contemporary issues? And what is the obligation of lay Catholics to support political positions taken by the church hierarchy? Our guest today is Professor Michael Budde, who is a professor of Catholic Studies and Political Science and senior research professor at the Center for World Catholicism and Intercultural Theology at DePaul University in Chicago. Among his books are The Borders of Baptism, Identities, Allegiances, and the Church, published in 2011, Two Churches, Catholicism and Capitalism in the World System, in 1992, and The Magic Kingdom of God, Christianity and Global Culture Industries, published in 1997. Welcome to Keeping the Faith, Professor Budde.
Thank you, Danny. Pleasure to be with you.
Let's begin by asking you to address my perception that the Catholic bishops have had a higher public profile in recent electoral politics in the last several election cycles, whereas in the past they may have had positions on moral issues that were also a matter of interest in public policy. Is it the case that in the last decade or so they've been more willing to say that voting a certain way can actually put one's faith in jeopardy? An example I'm thinking of is in the 2004 election cycle, several bishops announced publicly that they would refuse Senator Kerry the Eucharist if he approached them at a Mass. He at the time was the Democratic presidential nominee and also said that while he was personally opposed to abortion in matters of legislation, he would support keeping abortion legal. Is this something new in clerical involvement in electoral politics?
I think these things tend to go in cycles, quite honestly. I think that the extent to which the bishops as a group, for example, give regular sort of guidelines to the faithful, things that bishops hope that voters, Catholic and non-Catholic, will keep in mind as they form their decisions, those have been a commonplace for well over 30 to 40 years at a minimum. They tend to be at a fairly general level of concern. They list a whole range of issues and values that they would hope would be reflected in the public policy process. How much attention is paid to that by the outside or by the news media, by interest groups and so on, that tends to wax and wane. So during a campaign where you have, for example, a Roman Catholic like John Kerry running for the vice presidency, those kinds of inputs tend to get more attention than when there's not a Catholic on the ballot, for example. Or if there's something on the policy agenda in that year that tends to be more controversial or related more closely to something that the leadership of the church has taken a position on, then those things are more closely scrutinized. But in and of themselves, they're neither new nor particularly noteworthy.
In the local diocese, which covers central Illinois, Bishop Jenke from Peoria sent a letter to each of the congregations asking it that it be read at each of the masses on the Sunday prior to Election Day. And the first part of the letter had very pointed criticisms of some of the policies of the Obama administration. And then the letter included with an exhortation to vote. It didn't stipulate which way to vote, but I gather the intent was clear. Is there any evidence that these sorts of efforts produce a change in the way the Catholic faithful actually vote?
You know, to my knowledge, there's no real substantive evidence that those types of interventions make a significant impact one way or the other, either on turnout nor on how people actually vote, which direction they tend to go. One thing that's important to keep in mind that sometimes is lost by people who are a little on the outside of the conversations is that the Catholic Church is a radically decentralized type of a movement and organization. So there's hundreds of local bishops in the United States. They all have different understandings and different approaches to what they want to say and do and where they want to sort of invest their moral capital from one day to the next. So that what one feels is worth speaking out for in one diocese may not be reflected in the one next door. My sense is that the types of statements that encourage people to think or lean one way or another in the process tends mostly to reinforce those who are already persuaded, mm-hmm. tends to preach to the choir, as it were, rather than provide a substantive intervention that would make someone else who's leaning the other way or leading toward another candidate or party to stop, reconsider, and actually make a change. There's no strong evidence I'm aware of that links that in any kind of a causal fashion. It gets lots of attention. It's a matter of conversation, sometimes local controversy, but there's no evidence that there's a Catholic vote to be delivered by anybody, much less by bishops and priests in the local parishes.
We'll explore this theme a bit further, but this is a show that invites listener participation. So I will give out the phone numbers now and invite those of you who are tuned in to contribute to the conversation. The local number is 217-333-9455. The toll-free number is 800-222-9455. Recently I read a biography of Joseph P. Kennedy, which covered a lot of the Boston political history from the last third of the 19th century when his grandfather and father-in-law became active in politics into the middle of the 20th century, resulting in John Kennedy being elected. And in the large cities where there was a significant Catholic population, you had a kind of Catholic vote and maybe even to some sense could refer to politics being dominated by Catholics simply by their sheer numbers. But my impression from reading that book was that in the middle of the 20th century, maybe after or beginning with the election in 1928 when Smith, who was the first Catholic who was on a ticket for the presidency, lost, that there was a kind of interest among politicians to keep a bit of distance between their political positions and their faith, so that an example of this would be Kennedy's famous speech that he gave to the Baptists in Texas, assuring them that he would vote on what he thought was the best public policy for the U.S. and not be dictated by the church. Is that perception correct, that at one time the hierarchy would have been more content to be behind the scenes and not speak directly into the public arena?
I think that in most cases in the run of ordinary politics, particularly at local levels in big cities, that church institutions were closely tied to political parties and political machines. It was part of, in many places, the Northeast, like Boston, in the Midwest, places like Chicago, Detroit, and so on, that was very much an ethnic immigrant phenomenon where mostly poor immigrants from one or another country of the world were sort of pushed or banded together in a culture that really was fairly ambivalent about them, was happy to have them here to exploit for cheap labor, but didn't want their politics, didn't want their religion, didn't want their distinctiveness. And so, in large part, as defensive measures, I think Catholic parishes and pastors and bishops took on a lot of de facto responsibilities for community well-being, for public welfare, and so on, that otherwise would have worked to the detriment of people in their neighborhoods and their communities. Those things start to change in the years after the Second World War. Suburbanization, the growth of the interstate highway system, the decline of big city political machines because of political reform, because of changes in electoral laws, just demographic transitions. Most of those things have gone the way of the dinosaur, and with it, that particular kind of urban, ethnic, religious set of coalitions that the Boston circumstance was sort of a classic example of. So what's come to take its place has varied dramatically, I think. In some places, in some big cities, you have still very much some aspects of the old kinds of local community involvements built around parishes or built around pastors, but now the profile is very different. It's not so much neighborhoods that are predominantly ethnically Irish or Polish or Italian. It's people from Latin America, people from Mexico, immigrants from Asia, and so on. So while some of the problems are the same, the profiles and the dynamics are very different. And then the way that those things connect to politics at the state or national level, I would say in a lot of respects, is very different than it was 50 or 60 years ago.
We may return to this, but we have a caller already from Mattoon, Illinois, on line 4. So welcome to Keeping the Faith. Go ahead with your question.
Thank you. Good evening. Professor Otto, I just want to remind you as well, I believe it was Harry Truman that was asked about Kennedy's Catholicism at the time of the election and quipped that he was more afraid of the pop than the pope in his influence. But for your guest, you mentioned that the we do have hundreds, thousands of bishops across the United States. I would point out that over the last half century, the most liberal pope we have had was Paul VI, and it's a bit of a stretch to call him liberal. And if popes appoint the cardinals and cardinals the bishops, we've gotten a fairly conservative priesthood. And I'll hang up and listen.
Go ahead and with your response, Professor Buddy.
Well, it's certainly true that the Vatican has a particular sort of cast to it in terms of its preferences, its notion of what important issues are and are not, and so on. One of the things that makes all of this complicated is that when you move from the realm of politics to the realm of religion, you find that a lot of the categories that are second nature to us fit fairly poorly. Ideas about liberal and conservative, left and right, that are derived from secular politics, don't always capture some of the complexities that a religious movement or a religious tradition puts forward. Someone like Pope Paul VI in the 1960s and 70s, for example, often is thought of as being conservative because he reaffirmed the Catholic traditional prohibition on artificial contraception. At the same time, he was strongly critical of the way that the international economic system worked in favor of poor countries against rich countries. In a lot of cases, he sounded like socialist critics of capitalism. So he's, it's hard to sort of always pigeonhole these things in boxes that we can keep stable and that we think that they make consistent sense across a whole range of issues. One of the things that makes studying and reflecting about politics in the church in the United States so interesting is that it's the Catholic experience in the U.S. has always been kind of a love-hate relationship. Catholicism was not at all welcomed in the United States through most of U.S. history. It was thought of as an alien thing, a threat to democracy. It was thought of as a return to the authoritarianism of old Europe that had to be resisted by the Protestant leaders politically and culturally in the United States for hundreds of years. So to, you know, in that kind of a context and climate, what most of the experience or most of the tendency of Catholic leaders had been was to try to be more patriotic than the native-born, to be more pro-American than their Protestant brothers and sisters, to the point of, in some respects, minimizing any of the distinctiveness of the Catholic tradition, where it might in fact have something constructively critical to say about American democracy or economics or politics, for fear of being seen as an outsider or being seen as disloyal. So that by the time you get to our day, to the extent that people have been deeply formed to be more American than Catholic or American than Christian, makes all these other conversations a lot more complicated.
Sure. The comment you made about Pope Paul VI and at the simultaneously being liberal or progressive in his view of economics and conservative on contraception, my impression is the same would be true of Pope John Paul II, who had several encyclicals on economic justice alongside reiterating some very conservative positions on contraception and then abortion.
And I think that's one of the reasons that when it's robust and when it's interesting, Catholicism in the United States is hard to digest for either of the main political parties, because there's something that doesn't fit with whatever the orthodoxy of the parties are at one time. On the one hand, you have someone like John Paul, who's conservative on questions like abortion or mercy killing and so on, but then is steadfastly opposed to capital punishment, opposed the U.S. war in Iraq, and so on. And so there's things that the political right finds awkward and uncomfortable in that embrace, and things that the political left finds hard to be at peace with. And I think, in principle, that's a good thing. The fact that it's become sort of tied up with the pathologies of the American political party system, I think, works to the detriment of the church as well as to the larger society.
Is it the case that some of the changes in the 60s and then the Supreme Court ruling in Roe v. Wade in the 70s precipitated a change in the willingness of the bishops to speak out very firmly and directively? So in the 1960s, contraception became reliable and relatively inexpensive, and you know, there wasn't any obvious way to know who was using it and who wasn't, other than perhaps the dearth of children. And then abortion is legalized in Roe v. Wade. And my recollection is Mario Cuomo, when he was governor, who gave a landmark speech at Notre Dame in the 1980s addressing his responsibilities as a Catholic and his responsibilities as a politician. And he sort of articulated the point of view that as a Catholic he can be personally opposed to abortion while not working to legislate against abortion as a politician. And now more recently it seems like the abortion issue, at least for some Catholics, seems to be the paramount issue, and so it symbolized by several of the bishops saying that a Catholic politician who does not support legislation against abortion, in a sense, has self-excommunicated himself,
right,
and ought not to receive communion. Is there a sense in which the abortion issue has made them more willing to be directly engaged in concrete legislative issues?
You know, I think so. If you look back in retrospect, I think that's probably the case. And I think part of the reason why is that in terms of the moral theology that goes into traditional Catholic discernment on matters like abortion, for example, it doesn't come out of the same set of ideas that, for example, would find contraception morally objectionable in the area that contraception is an aspect of human sexuality, notions of familyhood and notions of human nature and so on. Catholic ethical discernment on abortion, more generally, has been in the area of homicide areas of lethal means to solve social problems. So in that respect, it fits in the family of issues more closely, like capital punishment, like the just war, like pacifism, and so on. And I think that Catholic leadership has thought that those were substantially more crucial issues in the public realm, certainly by the 1970s, than were questions about contraception, which, as a legislative matter, they tended to try to separate from questions about the ethics or the legality of abortion per se. So I think that it did galvanize and it did mobilize many aspects of church leadership, because this was thought to be a qualitatively different kind of question than the question of contraception, which was legalized by the courts and then state legislatures in the 1960s. And what's come from that, I think, has been hard to come to a single conclusion on. On the one hand, millions of people have been mobilized. On the other hand, the Catholic tradition, including its bishops, have always maintained that they are not a single-issue church. They can't boil down integrity in the Catholic tradition to one issue or one set of concerns, because it's a big world and a long life. And so while there are some bishops, for example, who said that, well, you know, abortion pretty much is the deal-breaker issue. If you're not right on this one, it doesn't matter how right you are on everything else. There have been others who have said, well, it's, you know, life's a lot more complicated than that. We often don't get perfect choices or good alternatives in the political realm. And so the kinds of discernment not only voters but also church leaders have to engage in with this is often going to be less than perfect. It's going to be more in the realm of compromise and more in the realm of trying to figure out where the least bad set of options are in a political system that seems intent on returning less than optimal choices on a fairly consistent basis.
We have another caller wanting to join the conversation. We'll go now to line one in Urbana. Welcome to Keeping the Faith.
Thank you. I have 16 years of Catholic education. My mother was in particular touched by the Roe v. Wade decision and spent her entire life in defense of the Right to Life movement. And it was an extremely moral position that she took, and I respect her for it. However, many of my contemporaries have just been so disgusted with the actions of the administration of the church, the bishops, the pope, local priests, in terms of the predators and the abuse of young boys in particular. And as a moral issue, I wonder why the Catholic Church has not taken a better stand about the importance of that moral issue. And I would suggest that issue itself has caused more people to leave the church than did the birth control issue. And I'd like to have your response to that.
Go ahead.
Well, that's a powerful statement, and a lot of people would share your views. The credibility of, I guess, institutional leaders in the Catholic Church in the United States has taken a beating fairly consistently over the last 40 to 50 years from a variety of different kinds of issues and shortcomings and failings. Certainly the way in which the pedophilia phenomena has been handled, mishandled, done poorly in so many places is another major obstacle for many people. And it's of a piece with other kinds of things that had the effect of putting a wedge between the faithful, both in the pews and those who didn't show up in church, and those who aspired to speak about the significance of the faith in everyday life in the public realm.
Yes, it has. And the statement that you made, the key statement that you made about the shortcomings and the failures, I think if we're all open-minded, we would look at those shortcomings and failures as human traits. Somehow, the position on birth control does not take into account the shortcomings and failures of the woman who becomes pregnant and the person who helped her to become pregnant. And so in one situation, we have a moral situation of the priests, and they're kind of excused for their shortcomings. But when we see a young woman who finds herself to be pregnant, we don't think about those shortcomings and failures. We think about it's morally wrong, period.
Well, I think that, you know, all parts of the church and all parts of society in general could do with a lot more compassion and a lot less judgmentalism. I think that we've already seen kind of the limits of sort of holier than thou politics, both in the church and in the political realm.
And if the politician says his position is such that he's opposed to abortion, but as far as being a legislative leader who makes decisions, he has to make decisions for the whole country, then we say, okay, he can't receive communion. Is that not judgmental?
I think one of the places where the church's efforts against abortion, for example, took a wrong turn was, I think, too early and for too long they focused almost exclusively on the question of the legality of abortion as a procedure, rather than looking at ways to address the problems that underlie it, questions about how to build a culture that respects life in its vulnerable stages that don't require the coercive power of the state. I mean, people that don't like abortion have been active in everything from adoption to all sorts of things that provide real help. So it's not simply a matter of, you know, sort of leaving people on their own to fend for themselves if they find themselves with difficult circumstances. But so much time and so much effort has been put into the political question that I think opportunities to be more creative with how to address that issue and tie it into everyday life, tie it into ways to address it in context that maybe reframe the question have been lost. I think that's been unfortunate over the years.
Yeah, I would agree with you because, you know, this issue of supporting the woman who maintains a child, keeps a child, that does not really apply in the real world in terms of helping that woman once her child is born and needs support and services. And it's just never been there, ever since the 70s. And so that's a nice idea, but the Catholic Church, for one, has not come forward and said, we will support these people. And so this is an issue in the Catholic Church that I think you need to take a good, I know you take a good look at, but I think it's one that has really severely diminished the respect of Catholicism with many former Catholics.
We want to thank the caller for her comments. We have other people wanting to join in the conversation, so we do need to move on. Before we go to our next caller, I had said at the top of the hour when we started that we would also talk about the role of the nuns on the bus. And so I would like to ask you whether there's some degree to which gender is involved in this, so that the Leadership Council for Women Religious, which is the umbrella organization representing a large number of Catholic nuns in the U.S., has come under criticism from the Vatican for not being attentive enough specific to the issues of contraception, abortion, and for advocating, I believe, too much for ordaining women. And I was on their website of the LCWR, and I saw that they have a list of, you know, probably 10 issues on their opening homepage, justice issues, climate change, environment, comprehensive health care reform, Haiti, immigration policy reform, and so on. And these sort of hot-button issues of abortion and contraception and so on don't show up in that list of issues. Is there a sense in which this is a gender issue, that the Catholic religious women who are leaders of a sort in the church, although they're not part of the teaching magisterium, have a different perspective on this based upon gender?
Well, I'm sure that for some people in the conference, and I'm sure for some women religious questions of gender are significant in shaping questions of priorities and agendas and so on. I think in addition to that, that it's hard to appreciate, I think, I mean, this, the 40th anniversary of the abortion decision, I think it's hard to appreciate how in the early years, after Roe versus Wade for the first 10 to 15 years, much of the opposition, much of the unease, much of the public criticism of Roe versus Wade came from liberal circles rather than conservative circles. Didn't come from the Republicans or libertarians. I mean, there was a lot of conservative Southerners who thought abortion paid for by the federal government was a swell idea because it would keep down the number of poor and minority children that would otherwise have to be supported at taxpayer expense. But I think that in the 1980s in particular, the extent to which those kinds of issues were in effect co-opted by the Republican Party and by the so-called New Right political movement, I think turned off anybody else who might have qualms about or reservations about unrestricted abortion on demand to the point where the issue just became toxic. It became a loser that not only you couldn't do anything with, but that by even addressing it, you found yourself shut out of any kind of dialogue on any of the other important questions of the day. And I think that was lamentable, and I think that that's in part a product of political decisions that were ultimately incorrect about how closely to tie those questions to matters of electoral politics in the 1980s, trying to elect Ronald Reagan as president, for example, because he was the so-called pro-life president, who in fact not only did nothing for that movement on those issues, but was hostile and in fact, I think, set back concerns of the church on a variety of other concerns, whether it was care for the poor, whether it was armed intervention in Central America, take your pick.
This is Speaking the Faith. We're about midway through the program. We have a caller waiting on line three, which we will come to just as soon as I make a few announcements about upcoming shows. Next week, February 3rd, Steve Shoemaker will be back, and he will be talking with Reverend Tim Bossenbrook of Hessel Park Christian Reformed Church about the Veritas Forum here at the U of I. February 10th, Steve Shoemaker will be here again with Lynn Warfel, a farmer from Tolono who is also a poet, and they will be Lynn will read some of his poetry about Central Illinois farm life. And February 17th, Steve's guest will be Rebecca Ginsburg, director of the Education Justice Project, which provides University of Illinois courses for credit in the Danville Correctional Center. We now have a caller in line two, Charleston. You've been very patient, so we invite you to join in the conversation. Line two in Charleston.
Hi. Sorry. When I called, it was to respond to this discussion about abortion and contraception, because you were addressing them, it seemed, mostly from political and economic. You talked about fit. And, of course, another way that they can be seen in terms of fit is that they were significantly different kinds of issues for women, maybe, than they are for other people. And so I wanted to hear some discussion about gender and the Catholic Church, and you've done that. I wonder if, in terms of the nuns on the bus and the, you know, the real deep kind of anger that I think maybe a lot of people have felt for decades concerning the treatment of women by the Catholic Church, I wonder if maybe you could just address that a little bit and talk about whether or not you've seen any significant changes, because I think for a lot of people there have not been any. Thank you. I'll hang up and listen.
Well, if you want evidence for the impact of the decline or the movement away from leadership in the church by women, particularly women religious, you need only look as far as the fate of Catholic education in the United States. Generations of immigrants were educated well and educated cheaply, mostly because dedicated women took virtually no salary and had no retirement benefits, but took it as their mission to educate the children of the immigrants and the children of farmers and children of people working in industrial labor, those women are gone. Catholic education has gone from being affordable for almost everyone to increasingly being the province of the wealthy only. And I think that the disillusionment of women has been part of that shortfall. It's not the only manifestation of it, certainly. But I think that on the one hand, greater opportunities in society outside the church has meant that women with talents and women with intelligence who had a passion to serve others could become lawyers, could become social workers, could become physicians, could become, you know, had a much wider range of options open to them than may have been the case in the 1920s or 1930s, for example. And at the same time, the inability of the Catholic tradition to articulate its views on gender and the notion of distinctiveness but not inequality hasn't been very persuasive to large segments of the Catholic population. And people are voting with their feet. They're staying home. They're not participating, or they participate selectively as they find they can in good conscience while keeping themselves distant from the more disagreeable aspects of the tradition as they experience it.
Is there any attempt to try to figure out how to incorporate women in leadership positions, or is the notion of the formal authority of the magisterium so entrenched that it's impossible to bring women in and incorporate
them? Well, you know,
them.
one of the good things about the Catholic way of being in the world is that in many ways it's a lot more open to individual and group initiative than people might think on the outside. The vast majority of things that happen that are described as Catholic initiatives, whether it's education, whether it's media, whether it's culture, whether it's novelists, doesn't get prior approval from a priest or a bishop, doesn't get cleared by the Vatican. It's just initiatives taken by people of faith who feel called to do something special or to do something in a way that connects their faith to the particular needs of the time as they perceive them. So in that respect, it's a much more kind of an open-ended sort of a process. People who don't find the teachings of the official church to their liking on questions of women leadership, for example, start their own things. They don't necessarily formally break with the magisterium, but they don't necessarily ask its permission to set up soup kitchens, set up shelters, protest against war, work with prisoners, educate immigrants. So there's kind of a dance back and forth that, you know, people who are not necessarily pleased with the circumstance where leadership is defined along predominantly male-oriented lines don't just quit and they don't just do nothing. They find a third way forward. And I think that's been one of the saving graces of the Catholic tradition, both in the United States and elsewhere. And I think that's probably going to typify its future as well. Some of these neuralgic issues will continue to be divisive or continue to be stumbling blocks for some people, for other people for whom they provide continuity and stability, and other people will continue to affirm those aspects of it that they can, and try to encourage their brothers and sisters to think and talk for the long term about other ways to do and be Catholic in a very complicated place.
I would like to announce that on February 8th, Sister Mary Ellen Lacey, who is associated with Nuns on the Bus, is going to be here at the University of Illinois on campus at the Friday Forum at the University YMCA. That meets at noon and goes for 1 hour. And so people might be interested in hearing what she has to say. The Nuns on the Bus achieved a fair amount of publicity I assume you've got more knowledge about them and the effects that they're having than I do as an outsider looking at this. Is this becoming a movement? I know that they had a bus tour, two-week bus tour, holding press conferences across the U.S. And I think what precipitated that was actually pushback against the budget that Congressman Ryan had proposed. But I have the impression that they also include sort of a basket of other issues that we've been talking about. Nuns on the bus is a very catchy phrase. And, you know, for many people, my daughter commented when I was telling her about the show we were going to do that when she thinks of nuns, she thinks of Sound of Music. And I think for many people in the U.S., they have images of traditional nuns from movies. But, you know, to actually encounter one today, because they dress in civilian clothes generally, most people don't know it when they're in the presence of a nun. And so the phrase nuns on the bus evokes what? It's a kind of romantic idea of these people, women crossing the U.S., striking a blow for justice.
I mean, who doesn't like nuns? I mean, even the stereotypical frightening nuns of the movies and, you know, Catholic biographies of the 1950s were ultimately endearing in some respect to many people. Women religious nuns have always been seen as more approachable than priests, have seen as the more human, the more compassionate side of the church. And in many respects, they were the ones who dealt more directly with people's everyday needs and everyday problems. And I think that as women religious and their congregations went through the Second Vatican Council and did what the council encouraged them to do, which is take a look at your mission, take a look at your vocation. How might you do it in modern times? Are there things you would want to change, things you would want to shift toward or shift away from to more fully and adequately reflect the best of your vocation? So for a lot of them, that meant getting rid of some of the distinctive kinds of clothing and habits and so on, and trying to immerse themselves maybe more in the lives of the poor or in communities in need. And people still respond well to that. It's not the Sound of Music. It's not Sally Field as the Flying Nun, but it's in continuation with the idea that, you know, Father is, you know, Father's there and has an important role, but, you know, Sister gets things done for you. And I think that the Nuns on the Bus initiative, I think, in a creative kind of public relations aspect, recognized that set of associations in popular culture and tapped into it and said, well, people like nuns. They're, you know, they're not authoritarian, hierarchical kinds of, you know, shibboleths that, you know, would scare people or would, you know, incur the same kind of hostility. And the fact that they're raising issues that, you know, maybe don't get raised enough in other venues, I think works to their credit too.
Before I go to our next caller, let me give out the phone numbers again if anyone is interested in calling in. The local number is 217-333-9455, and the long distance number is 800-222-9455. Right now we have a caller from Champaign on line one. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, good evening. Thank you for the program. It's very interesting. I just wanted to make a quick comment. I was raised Catholic and left the church for many, many years and came back, I don't know, about 15 years ago. And here in Champaign-Urbana, in the community where I worship, one of the things that struck me, and I've come to the conclusion about Catholicism in general, is that it's kind of a percentage game with people. I mean, the idea you were talking earlier about how some bishops say that the abortion issue is a make or break issue of whether you're Catholic or not. But, you know, my experience is that, you know, everybody has their own percentage rate of what they consider themselves, I guess, Catholic, or how much of Catholic doctrine they believe in. And some people are 80%, some are 60%, heck, there's some people that are 20% Catholic and still call themselves Catholic. And I firmly believe that, you know, there's probably no 100% Catholic, not even the Pope. He might be kind of like sterling silver, 99.9% pure. And I think that I used to have trouble with that, but I've come to embrace that idea as you know, you don't have to throw it all out. There are parts of it, you know, like you were saying, there are some people that follow their own calling, and it may be contrary to what the church believes. They don't have to have permission to do that, but it's more of a modern interpretation and acceptance of where they are in Catholicism, and not so much Catholicism, but their belief in strict Catholic doctrine. And I'll just listen off the air. Thank you.
Well, I think you raise a good point that one of the things that the Second Vatican Council reminded Catholics of is that the non-negotiables of the faith, those things that one accepts or finds themselves outside the mainstream of the Catholic tradition, are really fairly few. They're articulated in the creed. They're things like the Trinity. They're things like the incarnation of Christ. They're things of that nature that you know, Christians of many traditions can affirm. Catholics have been arguing among themselves over big issues for hundreds and hundreds of years. That's part of what it means to be Catholic, that division and disagreement per se doesn't lead to walking off and starting your own thing. It means you stay and argue with the people with whom you share these larger, deeper convictions about the nature of God, about the nature of the human person, and so on and so forth. And I think the thing that makes all those questions of identity and culture even more poignant in our day is that one of my frustrations about the experience of Catholicism in the United States for too many people is that it's so small. It's too small. The idea that what one experiences in a local congregation is what there is to experience in a 2,000-year-old tradition that's 1.2 billion people around the world, we wouldn't think that about a political movement or an ideology or an artistic movement, the idea that you need to just take one sample and that's all there is. But yet, that's how I think, regrettably, many people form their kind of experienced and opinions of what it is to talk about the church or what it means to talk about Christianity. It's what happened to me when I was 12 down at the local congregation where I had some idiot priest or I had someone who disrespected me. If you take a look at one of the big changes for which there's really no precedent, and the center with which I'm affiliated at DePaul focuses on this, is that there's a worldwide transformation of Christianity that really has no, there's no parallel either in the other world religions or within Christian history. 100 years ago, 2/3 of the world's Catholics and 2/3 of the world's Christians lived in Europe and North America. That's it. Nowadays, that number is upside down, to the point where 2/3 of the world's Christians, 2/3 of the Catholics, they don't live in Europe. They don't live in the United States. They're mostly in what we call the Global South. It's Africa, it's Latin America, it's Asia. And boy, you talk about shuffling the cards. New priorities, new questions, new issues, new sets of what's most important, what is it that the church ought speak to and for and from. Those questions are all going to be thought through and experienced differently as the European quality of Catholicism, for example, gets transformed. And it's being transformed in the United States in the most direct fashion, where the composition of the church is increasingly less and less of a European institution and much more has the color, the flavor, and the character of people coming from all over the world, especially from poor countries.
How will that, you know, impact, I mean, some of the traditional ethnic groups that were the core of Catholicism through the 19th century and most of the 20th century? I've seen statistics that show that, you know, on one of the hot issues of the day on gay marriage, that for young people under 30, it's almost ceased to be seen as a moral issue. And that cuts across religion so that, you know, evangelical Protestants are worrying about having lost that issue for the next generation. And I assume that it would generally be true of Catholic young people, too. So if you have one part of the Catholic Church that simply sees an issue such as gay marriage or same-sex relationships as a dead issue, they accept it, they don't see anything there to talk about, how can the Church over time finesse that issue? It seems like it becomes increasingly difficult to articulate a moral point of view that is just doesn't get any traction among your members.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think one of the big sorts of areas of, you might want to call it creative tension, but it's going to be tension nonetheless, is in the different kinds of predispositions, different kinds of appraisals on a whole range of social and political and moral questions among Christians, in this case, if you want to talk about Catholics, you know, who come predominantly from Africa and Asia and so on, very, very poor countries, where on sexual morality or sexual ethic issues, homosexuality and so on, the broad tendency tends toward a very conservative position, unlike in the United States, where, as you say, the idea that there could be a persuasive case on religious or theological terms against homosexual relationships is largely incredible to people under 30. Yet at the same time, those same Christians that are so-called conservatives on issues of sexual ethics from West Africa or so on, are much more critical of the way the international political system is structured to favor the powerful countries, much more persuaded than their European or North American brothers and sisters that, for example, the world economy is a rigged game that benefits the rich instead of the poor, and that those are the issues the Church ought to be concentrating on. So they will be interesting times. And the leadership is changing to reflect that. If you take a look at the, the most, in some ways, the slowest parts of, for example, Catholicism to reflect these changes, the composition of the hierarchy at the international level, more and more of the bishops are coming from poor countries, more of the cardinals, those who will choose the pope, come not from Europe, not from Italy, but from Brazil, from Nigeria, from the Philippines, from South Korea, and what the Holy Spirit will do when that time comes, is anybody's guess. I think it'll be surprising to everybody, no matter how it plays itself out. But it's clear that the cards are being shuffled in some significant ways.
One of the hot-button issues of a generation ago was the issue of divorce, and most states in the U.S. liberalized divorce laws, and the trend was away from marriage as a lifelong commitment. I don't know, what is it, approximately half of all marriages now end in divorce. And the Catholic Church finessed that issue by maintaining its position that divorce is impossible. What God has put together, humans can't put asunder, so a valid marriage cannot be separated. But they have finessed the issue through annulment. And so I don't know if Catholic statistics on the separation of marriage through annulment is as high as it is on divorce for the general population, but it seems like annulment is fairly routine as a way for Catholics to dissolve these unions. Is there any way forward on any of the other issues that we've talked about that the Church can sort of say, we've dug in, so this is our position, but through canon law we can actually accommodate what is de facto the practice in our culture?
Well, I'm not sure I'd agree that annulment is a way to finesse the question of divorce or failed marriages. I mean, I think that in practice, in many places, annulments are not an easy matter to obtain. They reflect a judgment that the capacity to enter into a sacramental marriage was not there at the outset. That there was some fatal defect either of capacity or understanding that made a sacramental marriage untenable or not possible from the outset. The real question is, and And the church recognizes in some cases that civil divorce is a better alternative than people staying together. Where things get sticky is when people remarry after a civil divorce and then want to participate in the sacraments of the church if they've not had an annulment previously. And that's a pastoral problem. It's dealt with, I think, in different ways in different places. It's a question, as you say, of canon law at some level. But again, I think that there are lots of people for whom, you know, they don't wait for the church authorities to figure out a way to enter them more fully and completely into the sacramental practice of the church. There are many pastors who tend to not really be interested in the marital status of people presenting themselves for the Eucharist, figuring that there are lots of different aspects of human limitations that God's best able to sort out rather than a pastor standing in front of a communion line. So those are enduring challenges or problems. They don't admit of any immediate solution at the level of policy, but at the same time, there are millions of people every day who sort of live with that paradox and in many cases do great things with and through the church in spite of it.
We have just a few minutes left. Our time is winding down. I'll make a few more announcements. Steve Shoemaker, the regular host of this show, is teaching a poetry class for seniors through OLLI, the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, here at the University of Illinois, starting this Thursday, January 1st, and it meets from 1:30 to 3. This meets once a week for 8 weeks. He says no homework, no grades, just great poems from the Psalms to the present. So if any of you are interested in joining in this course with Steve Shoemaker, you can go to www.olli.illinois.edu. Next week, Steve will be back on Keeping the Faith, talking with Tim Bossenbrook of Hassel Park Christian Reformed Church about the Veritas Forum here at the U of I. And the following week, Lynn Vorfel will be here reading some of his poetry about Central Illinois farm life. And 3 weeks out, February 17th, Steve's guest will be Rebecca Ginsburg, director of the Education Justice Project, which delivers U of I courses for credit in the Danville Correctional Center. The University YMCA Friday Forum Series, which meets each Friday all spring semester beginning February 8th, has a theme of faith in action, which dovetails very closely with the interests of this show. The first one coming up February 8th has Sister Mary Ellen Lacey from the movement Nuns on the Bus. February 15th, Aliyah Bilal from the Inner City Muslim Action Network will be the guest at the Friday Forum. And February 22nd, Kim Bobo, founder and executive director of Interfaith Worker Justice, will be there. The complete schedule for the Friday Forum can be found at the University YMCA website, universityymca.org, on the internet. We've been talking today about keeping the faith, issues among contemporary Catholics. Our guest has been Michael Budde from DePaul University in Chicago. We thank you for joining with us today. We've had a very fascinating show, and we'll see you next week.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
In Christian America and the Kingdom of God, Dr. Richard Hughes contends religious and political leaders have espoused the belief that America is a Christian nation in order to reinforce a sort of messianic nationalism, proposing the U.S. is God's chosen nation, a perception leading to what is, in fact, very unchristian behavior. I'm Craig Cohen. The motivation and meaning behind the phrase Christian nation on the next Focus. Join the conversation Monday morning at 10 on WILL AM 580.
Salafi Muslims believe Sharia law should govern every aspect of life.
We are calling for pure ideology, pure ethics regarding the day-to-day lifestyle.
The ultra-conservative